Coming up, religious responses to the tragedy in Orlando. Plus, Donald Trump will meet with hundreds of evangelical leaders this week. Kim Lawton reports that many of these usually Republican voters have ongoing concerns about Trump. And welcoming strangers, Lucky Severson reports on one state's success resettling refugees.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. Horror and grief after the massacre at a gay nightclub in Orlando. 49 people and gunman Omar Mateen were killed and dozens were wounded. Prayer vigils and memorial services have been held across the country. Religious leaders swiftly and strongly condemned the violence. Pope Francis called it homicidal folly and senseless hatred. Southern Baptist Convention leader Ronnie Floyd said, quote, "This attack against gay Americans in Orlando is an attack on each of us." Mateen was a Muslim born in the U.S. who pledged his allegiance to ISIS and other terror groups. More than 200 Islamic leaders released an unprecedented joint statement asserting that, quote, "any such acts of violence violate every one of our prophet's teachings."
"We condemn it in the strongest possible terms. It violates our principles as Americans and as Muslims."
The attacks have generated new discussions about religion and homosexuality. Several leaders in the gay community said some Christians also could be held responsible because of their opposition to homosexuality. Florida Roman Catholic Bishop Robert Lynch conceded in his blog that religion, quote, "often breeds contempt for gays, lesbians, and transgender people," unquote. Islam has traditionally opposed homosexuality, but Muslim leaders said that would never justify such actions.
"Whatever they say about the practice of homosexuality is irrelevant to the fact that we are committed to respect the other."
In the wake of the incident, many faith-based activists renewed their calls for stricter gun control measures. Several religious leaders supported a new bill to ban the sale of guns to those on terrorism watch lists. The Dalai Lama, who is visiting the U.S., urged Americans not to blame all Muslims for the tragedy.
"You cannot generalize because of some of the follower of Islam's behavior. The whole Islam is something militant or negative. It's absolutely wrong."
On the campaign trail, Donald Trump repeated his call for a temporary ban on Muslims coming to the U.S. He also said American mosques should be checked for extremism.
"If we want to protect the quality of life for all Americans, women and children, gay and straight, Jews and Christians, and all people, then we need to tell the truth about radical Islam, and we need to do it now."
Hillary Clinton said identifying and stopping lone wolf terrorists would be a top priority for her. She called Trump's proposals dangerous.
"Trump's words will be, in fact, they already are, a recruiting tool for ISIS to help them increase its ranks of people willing to do what we saw in Orlando."
This coming Tuesday, Trump has planned a closed-door, invitation-only meeting in New York City with hundreds of evangelical leaders. Evangelicals are a key Republican constituency, but many are not sure whether they can support Trump. Kim Lawton has our special report.
At the Faith and Freedom Coalition's Road to Majority conference last week, presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump got a warm reception from this largely evangelical audience.
As you know, we've done very well with the evangelicals.
I think if you look at the things that we as conservative evangelicals believe in, life, marriage, religious freedom, support for Israel, and terrorism, I think Donald Trump stands for the positions that advance the good.
But among other evangelical Christians, including those who usually vote Republican, strong concerns remain about Trump's character, the strength of his political conservatism, and his suitability to be president.
I think he's erratic, I think he's unprincipled, I think he's unreliable, and I don't think that he can be depended on. I think he would be an active danger to the Republic if he were president.
Still others aren't sure what to think.
Evangelicals right now are, for the most part, simply watching the choices in front of them with a sense of horror.
For the past three decades, evangelicals have been a cornerstone of the GOP coalition. In the last election, almost 80% of them voted for Mitt Romney. But during this election cycle, they've been divided over Trump.
Some have decided to be very pragmatic. We've seen this among some leaders and among some voters as well. And if it looks like Trump's going to win, then they want to back him because they would prefer a Republican president, even if less than ideal, than a Democratic president. But there are other evangelicals that are very conflicted about this. So this is an unusually difficult election for many evangelicals.
John Green is director of the Bliss Institute at the University of Akron and a veteran scholar of religion and politics. He says a lack of enthusiasm among evangelical voters could have serious implications for Trump.
It's not just evangelicals. I mean, there are other pieces of the Republican Party that are in disarray as well. But because evangelicals play such a central role at the ballot box, that has to be a top priority for Republicans who want to be successful.
Prominent evangelical Peter Wehner is a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. He worked in the last three Republican administrations and has been an outspoken critic of Trump.
He has a view of power that really worries me a great deal. Speaking as a Christian, the evidence that we've seen of the contempt that he has for people that he considers weak, his bullying tactics, his cruelty, and he thinks that that might makes right, and that's very, very problematic from a Christian perspective, and it's very, very problematic for a person who's going to be president of the United States.
Some evangelicals, particularly Latinos, have been turned off by Trump's inflammatory rhetoric and his tough stand on immigration.
This idea of deporting and separating families, even those that have been here for 20 years, when their kids have been born here, that's outrageous. It's not practical. It doesn't even speak to a pro-life, pro-family, pro-faith ethos.
And there are lingering questions about Trump's character.
You have someone who has openly boasted of marital infidelity, serial adultery, someone who's made his living in the casino industry that I believe is predatory off of the poor, and someone who has used race baiting in this campaign in really unprecedented sorts of ways.
The Trump campaign has been stepping up its outreach to conservative Christians. In his speech at the Faith and Freedom Coalition, the candidate stressed what he described as their shared values. He promised to uphold the sanctity of life, appoint pro-life judges, fight what he called radical Islamic terrorism, and safeguard religious freedom.
We will restore faith to its proper mantle in our society. That's what we have to do, and we have to do that soon. We will respect and defend Christian Americans. Christian Americans.
The campaign is highlighting the support of prominent Christian leaders. Ohio pastor and religious broadcaster Frank Amedia of Touch Heaven Ministries has been named a liaison for Christian policy, a volunteer position. He, too, has heard the evangelical concerns.
We're not voting for a pastor-in-chief. We're voting for a commander-in-chief. So here's what I do. I ask him this question. Who are our alternatives right now?
Amedia admits he doesn't condone all of Trump's rhetoric.
what I've experienced and the people that I know that know him well and my friends and pastors, we see no racial bias. We don't see any religious bias. We don't see any sexism. Yes, we hear remarks that would be alarming, but let's face it, there's remarks that have come from the other side that are extremely alarming.
He says he's not bothered by Trump's apparent lack of religiosity.
I don't care if he's a born-again Christian or not. I know that that's going to get people mad at me again on the right side. What I care about is that he's raised himself up for Christian rights, for the First Amendment, for religious rights. It's very clear that Trump stacks up more on the line of what are Christian fundamental doctrines and concerns than Hillary or Obama do or they have.
Of course we're not electing someone to be pastor, and someone who is president of the United States does not need to be someone who shares the Holy Spirit with us or who shares a common doctrinal framework. But evangelical Christians have always said that character matters.
Russell Moore is head of the Southern Baptist Convention's Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission.
Surely we can agree that there are some things that would morally disqualify a person from office, regardless of what pragmatically that person would do. And so if we agree on that, then our question is simply, what is that?
Many evangelicals say they're still wrestling over what to do in November.
Whatever discomfort evangelicals have, and it's real discomfort with Donald Trump, that's not showing up in a warming toward Hillary Clinton.
It leaves me politically homeless. I'm not going to vote for Donald Trump under any circumstances. I'm not planning on voting for Hillary Clinton because she's a liberal and I'm a conservative and she stood against pretty much everything I've stood for in my public life.
Some are considering voting for a third party or write-in candidate. Others have decided to vote for Trump as the lesser of two evils. Ralph Reed of the Faith and Freedom Coalition predicts that if Trump keeps stressing their key issues, he will ultimately do well among evangelicals.
By definition, in a fallen world, every choice is an imperfect one. I think for us to reject the good because it isn't perfect or because the messenger is imperfect shows potentially a level of spiritual immaturity.
Reed says he's spearheading a massive get-out-the-vote effort among conservative Christians.
If you stay home, you essentially withdraw, and you're sort of voting by your absence that you're checking out of the process. That's not my reading of either the Bible or Jesus's teaching or New Testament teaching on how we are to function as men and women of faith in our earthly citizenship.
In recent elections, evangelical grassroots organizing has greatly benefited the GOP. But John Green questions whether Trump will inspire the same level of enthusiasm even among those who have decided to vote for him.
From a purely pragmatic point of view, they need each other. But of course, politics isn't all pragmatism. It's also about values. It's also about principles. Can evangelical leaders find a way to work with the Trump campaign? And frankly, can Donald Trump find a way to work with them?
The answers could help tip the balance in November. I'm Kim Lawton reporting.
In other news, a wide array of religious leaders joined forces to push for a new bill that would reform harsh sentencing guidelines. They gathered on the U.S. Capitol lawn to hold a prayer vigil and to ask for swift action by Congress. Advocates for the bill say the measure has been before the Senate since October, but legislators have delayed taking any action.
Our political act of courage today as we walk the halls of Congress is to say, Senator, Representative, we are people of faith and we call upon you to join us in prayer.
An investigation by the United Nations has found that ISIS committed genocide and other war crimes in its continued effort to exterminate the Yazidi religious minority in Syria and Iraq. The finding was based on actions taken by the Islamic State since August 2014 against 400,000 members of the Yazidi community. Yazidi men and boys who refused to convert to Islam were routinely killed. Officials have uncovered dozens of mass graves. Yazidi women were also targets and repeatedly raped. The UN is urging international action to halt the killing and to prosecute the perpetrators. Pope Francis made his first visit to the World Food Program, a UN agency that provides emergency food aid to 80 million people around the world. In a speech in Rome to thousands of workers and diplomats, Francis said it's a strange paradox that in times of war, weapons can get in, but food can't. As a result, Francis said, wars rather than people are fed, and hunger itself is used as a weapon of war. Friday marked the one-year anniversary of the mass shooting at Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, South Carolina, that killed 9 people. More than 24 events were planned, including an ecumenical service to remember the slain members and to honor the survivors. The husband of one of the victims, who's a pastor, urged people to remain focused on God throughout the anniversary. The Charleston tragedy spurred a national debate on the display of the Confederate battle flag. At their annual meeting in St. Louis this week, the Southern Baptist Convention took up the issue. It adopted a resolution that called the flag an emblem of slavery and asked that members discontinue its display, quote, as a sign of solidarity of the whole body of Christ, including our African-American brothers and sisters. The country's second largest religious group also approved a resolution that encouraged Southern Baptist Convention churches to welcome and resettle refugees. A new report by the International Organization for Migration said a record number of migrants worldwide, 5,400, died last year in attempts to cross national borders. Children accounted for a third of the dead. The report also concluded that increasingly the dead cannot be identified, often because they can't be found or because their bodies have badly decomposed, leaving many families wondering whether their loved ones are still alive. Monday, June 20th marks World Refugee Day. The Obama administration plans to resettle 85,000 refugees this year. Even though 30 or more state governors have said they don't want any more, and despite the fears of many people that among the newcomers might be terrorists. But Lucky Severson reports that in the state of Utah, refugees are accepted and welcomed, and religious groups are prominent in their resettlement.
This is not an uncommon sight at the Salt Lake City International Airport. Refugees arriving from all over the world to a warm embrace. Today, they're from Somalia and Nepal. Among those here to welcome them and help them is Martha Archuleta.
You've been here 2 years?
A volunteer with Catholic Community Services.
It's an opportunity for me to live out my faith. Christ gave us the example of caring for the poor and welcoming the stranger in our midst.
About 1,200 refugees will arrive here this year to a place that stands out, particularly among red conservative states, for its attitude toward refugees. They are welcomed here, unlike at least 30 other states that have said they are not welcome, especially those from Syria. That's where Khalud Abu Arida came from, along with her husband and 3 children.
Was it dangerous there?
Yes, yes, yes. And my husband 2 times went to jail. My children not safe for them.
Makes you wonder what's going on in their minds when they get here.
Aidan Batar is the Director of Immigration and Refugee Resettlement for Catholic Community Services. There are over 60,000 refugees now living in Utah. He says there is an important distinction between being classified as an immigrant and as a refugee.
An immigrant is somebody who left their country on their choice for a better future and better life. A refugee have to show a well-founded fear of persecution based on religious persecution, political opinion, based on membership in a social group, you know, and so forth. So the refugees have to meet that definition in order for them to be given a refugee status.
Aidan himself is a refugee and a Muslim. In Somalia, he was a practicing lawyer who fled his country in 1996.
I left my home country, Somalia, because of the civil war that started back in 1990. If it hasn't been the civil war, I would not have left my home country. I was forced to flee after losing a family member.
States that don't want refugees are concerned that there will be terrorists among them, but Aidan Bitar says that fear is unfounded. The vetting process, he says, is exhaustive. First, the United Nations High Commission for Refugees must determine that an individual or family qualifies as a refugee. That's a small percentage. Then the U.S. sends investigators to the camps.
Then they have to go to a screening process where they'd be fingerprinted, their names will be checked against a multiple database. The FBI, the CIA, and can check those individuals to make sure they're not linked with a terrorist, to make sure they don't have any criminal background.
The process on average takes 2 years and longer.
I understand why people have the fear, but refugees are not the ones that are harming this country. Ever since the refugee resettlement program started back in the 70s, we have more than 3 million successfully resettled in the United States. And those refugees are contributing members of our society.
Back in Syria, Khalud was a teacher of Arabic in Damascus. Now she drives a forklift at the LDS, or Mormon Humanitarian Center. She eventually hopes to teach here.
So scary, because everything here different. Culture, people, everything. And language, so hard. Yeah, but no, now, yeah, we love America. Yeah, and people here in Utah, very friendly.
Her husband is a chef. Their three children attend public school. This is Noor. She's 16.
I learned English so fast, and everything was quickly for me. I don't want to go back to Syria because I start my new life here. I start my new future here.
For 4 hours each weekday, Khalud and about 200 other refugees work sorting out clothing to be sent around the world. Tomorrow is payday, so everyone is wearing a smile.
What time will you?
In the afternoon, they learn English and how to get a job.
Refugees, after 6 months they've been in the country, when they get their first job, they're required to pay back their airfare.
For Khalud's family, airfare cost $8,000. The minute refugees arrive in the U.S., after being fingerprinted and another background check, they are given legal status to work, to go to school, and get benefits such as Medicaid. There's a furnished apartment waiting for them with furniture donated from throughout Utah. Everyone must learn English.
What will you say?
Imam Muhammad Metar immigrated from South Africa and arrived in Utah 9 years ago. He says Utah is benefiting from welcoming refugees.
They've gotten diversity. They've gotten more businesses now that want to come to Utah because they don't look at Utah as a state that wants to divide individuals. And I think if you want to call this an experiment, it has worked very well in their favor, economically, socially, politically, all around, I think.
It's not only Mormons and Catholics who are supporting refugees. There are dozens of nonprofit organizations and individuals from all faith groups who chip in.
If you look at the Mormons themselves, you know, have been persecuted. They've been there. They understand what a persecution means.
People here say the reason Utah is so welcoming to refugees is because the early settlers themselves were refugees. They were fleeing religious persecution all across the country to get here. Their leader and many of their men were murdered. Because so many Mormon converts came from Europe, President Rutherford B. Hayes asked Europe not to let any more migrate. So people here do empathize. And it's not only Mormons.
Islam teaches us to love our neighbors, to love one another, and also to help those who are most in need. That's what my faith teaches me, and that's what I believe.
Emily Stevens is a Mormon. She works for the Amar Foundation, an international nonprofit that provides health care and education to people living in refugee camps in Iraq.
To see what 30,000 people look like in one camp, which is more than the population of the town I live in, it really changed my perspective. A lot of them spoke really great English. They had college educations. They were just like me.
I'm Mormon and Fatu is Muslim. I think we just support each other in the ways that we connect with God.
In March, LDS church leaders launched a campaign called I Was a Stranger, based on the biblical mandate to welcome the stranger, asking members to donate their time and efforts to the refugee cause.
Certainly, there's no expectation or hope that people are going to be converting as a result. I do hope that at the end they have a warmer feeling about us and they think, oh, those Mormons are good people.
Don't judge the Muslim. They are not all the same. The same thing happened with us. Like, we thought American people, they're gonna be nice with us or something like that. But no, when we start to know them, they are really nice people.
After 5 years, refugees like Khalud's family can apply for U.S. citizenship. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Salt Lake City.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org/religionethics. As we leave you, the bells of the Washington National Cathedral tolling for the victims of the Orlando massacre.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.